there's so many signals out there, and it is picking the right signals and getting the right person to talk to the right person at the right time. It's better for the buyer because they're not being bombarded. It's better for the seller because a lot of times sellers spend 80% of the time on deals that will never convert, and only 20% of the time is on deals that will. And so you're optimizing their time too, so they'll be happy.
Plug into the minds of the world's cutting-edge innovators, visionaries, and thought leaders who are rewriting the rules of sales and success. It's your time to make an impact. I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Selling with Love podcast. I am extremely pumped for the episode we have today. I've had a lot of guests over the past months, maybe even from the start of the year, that have been in different niches, and I've been actually asking them a lot of questions about how sales have showed up in their lives, for their entrepreneurial journey, for building their business, for being an author. And what I'm bringing on today is someone that's actually very focused on revenue, focused on sales, and using some of the latest technology as well. It's a man that's really in the trenches and helping businesses really get more customers, get them to understand more how they behave on the digital space, convert them into clients. And the man has worn so many different hats as a founder. So I can't wait to dig into this story, have a bit more banter going on in the sales space. So if you're tuning into this podcast and you're finding that this is a change of pace, know that we're here to talk about sales. We're talking about Selling with Love, and I'm very excited to have Alan Zhao joining us. Now, if you're not familiar with Alan, he is one of the co-founders of Warmly. If you don't know about Warmly, we'll put some links in the show notes so you actually go and check out this website. It is a platform where it really allows you to convert website visitors. So if you're a company and you're trying to get more people that come to your website to become clients, this is a platform that leverages tons of data, AI, and all the fancy stuff. We'll talk a bit more about that in the conversation. But the man have played so many roles within this company and even in his own journey, being a restaurant manager, being in finance, tech, and now he is the head of marketing within this organization, hosts the Revenue Rebels podcast. And so I'm excited to bring him on the show to have a bit of sales talks and see what we're going to be doing today. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Jason. Good to be here.
Now, I've had a chance to start digging into Warmly. It sounds like you're quite on the cutting edge of the tech and the needs for the businesses. It sounds like you had a big background in sales, but I was so fascinated to see kind of the journey. I see restaurant manager was kind of in the middle of your whole ecosystem, which seems to be like the one that stands out in the journey. So I'd be curious to know, what got you into this journey here, and where did the sales manager kind of come into play, even coming from a place of restaurant?
Yeah, so I started my career in finance on the trading floor. It was a great time, learned a lot. It was in 2014. It was when recurrent neural networks were coming into the fray. And so I decided I wanted to join an AI company because I could see that movement coming. And I joined the AI company. It was called X.AI. It was before, you know, X.AI of today of Twitter. This was an email scheduling tool, automated email scheduling. And it was an extremely sophisticated technology applied to, in my opinion, a pretty simple domain, actually, email scheduling. And the company, like, they had some of the best data scientists out there, they had the best technology out there, but the problem itself was not deep enough. I guess I had this mentality of I wanted to solve real problems, and I was very young at the time. So my friend called me up and he was like, hey, I'm about to buy this restaurant. Do you want to join me? Because we have so many restaurant problems. I think it'd be a lot of fun. And I think you can apply some of your technology skills over to restaurant industry, which I think is kind of underserved. And this is our minimal understanding of how restaurants really work. There's actually a lot of technology out there. The problem is just that restaurants don't make much money. And the money comes from things like Toast, the POS system, Uber Eats, things that bring top line revenue. We didn't really understand that. We were trying to cut costs. It didn't work too well. But it was an extremely amazing experience because we ended up running a Vietnamese pho restaurant in the heat of Dallas, Texas. And it was awesome. But it was not a successful and a smart idea.
Well, it was a lesson learned still. You saw there was kind of an opportunity. It sounds like you came from an attitude that was already very hungry. I mean, background in finance obviously had something where you're very driven. You had the right kind of foundations. You got into a lot of tech. You were CTO. You were like a sales development rep. And so very often you see the people that are tech focused stay away from sales. And it sounds like you kind of jumped the boat on both. Does that make you kind of a unicorn in this field?
I'm not sure if it's a unicorn, but I think that everyone should do it. What I started to realize over time is that you don't know anything until you actually do the role itself. It's so easy to be on the outside and say like, oh, this is how you're supposed to do this. And this is what my friend does, or I've heard this on podcast before. And this makes a lot of sense to me in the moment. But every entrepreneur or venture capitalist or founder who's been very successful will always say the same thing. It's like, you're just trying to find the truth. There's this blob, this amorphous blob, and you just keep poking and prodding at it until you finally get the true shape of the blob. And once you see the true shape, then you can make your plans and action it from there. But until you get that true shape, then it's kind of useless to say, we should do this, we should do that, all this hearsay. So being in these different roles allows you to have empathy for salespeople, of course. What they do is very difficult. Same with engineers. I understand that's probably why these are the two most highest paid professions out there. Engineers are constantly banging their heads against things that, like, there's a million reasons why something doesn't work and you have to go find it. And then salespeople, there's a million reasons why someone won't buy your product and you just have to get around that somehow, whatever it takes. So both extremely difficult. And yeah, building empathy, understanding that if you learn a skill in one domain, it's not only practical, but it's almost guaranteed that you can learn that same skill to pick up something, find the truth of how it all works in a different domain. And the same would apply for being a CEO. It's just a different kind of skill. It'll be management, it'll be fundraising. There's a hidden truth to it, and you just need to figure that out.
Interesting. Yeah, well, what you speak about, I've seen that in organizations I've worked where it's like the tech people look at sales like they're a bunch of jokers that just have a very simple job, right? And the salespeople, I remember judging the tech people and just being like, they're overcomplicating everything and it's so slow and they have no idea what they're building. They don't understand even what the customer wants. And so they're out of touch with reality. So I find myself very curious to know, how did you end up like playing the translator between those two teams? And is it an active role you still have to do today?
It's really difficult to play the translator. It's hard for people to see it until they're actually in it. When I was in engineering, the only thing that mattered was that I shipped code that worked consistently and can scale and flexible and is bug free for as long as possible. And then do that within an engineering team, it's crazy. It's like, you know, you're like on a unicycle juggling 50 different things. The last thing you can think about is like, do the customers like, that's not my job. That's sales' job. Sales is supposed to figure that. That's products. That's not my, I have so much stuff going on. There's no way I can't even eat. I'm up at 12 a.m. pushing to production because of bugs. And then sales is sleeping right now because they have to wake up at 7, of course. So you just have different problems. There's no way to even factor that in because engineering is always a bottleneck. And then similarly on the sales side, it's like, I've seen it before. CEOs do it. VPs of sales do it. AEs do it. They're like, I'm so close to closing this deal. We're at the end of the quarter. Can we offer this thing that we don't have? Why can't we do that? You know what I mean? Like, it's the classic thing. Like, oh, we just need this one integration and then we'll buy the product. Oh my gosh, we can do it. No problem. And they turn back to the engineers like, can we do this? I already closed the deal. You have different problems here. I don't know if translating helps much.
Well, As a client, I've been that person asking the salesperson to deliver something and they've given me that promise and I've seen the product, didn't have it once I had it, but they're under their own pressure. They have to make those kind of incomplete. So now you're working on Warmly and you're actually playing a role of head of marketing as one of the co-founders. And so you're the click-through guy from what I understand. And so you've done the tech, you've done the sales, now you're in marketing. So the other place I often see some loss in translation and finger pointing is the differences between marketing and sales. Now that you've worn both hats, do you still see that there's a big difference? Because I've actually never witnessed the marketing versus sales battle because it's always been very integrated. So I'd be curious to know.
Oh, yeah. I think marketing's changed a lot. In my limited time in marketing, I've been in it for about 6-7 months now. I think a lot of people think that marketing is, one piece of it is just capturing demand in the moment. There's 5% of your market in market any given time. And so you have a lot of people just sending out mass sequences, emails, nurture campaigns like me. I think marketing over the years has become a lot more participatory and you'll see a lot of the stuff. People are starting to build really big brands. They'll push on content, they'll push on building community. And in my opinion, it's about building a movement. It's about building the church. The approach that we took is don't spend too much on ads. Actually, we don't spend any on ads. I barely know how our email software works. I think that's in someone else's hand. The most important thing is just to put our company on a map by building what I think, and I talked about this with our senior marketing person, and we call it the marketing church. And the idea here is that if you think about religion, a lot of religions probably didn't have a very big budget, but they spread very quickly and through word of mouth, and they became these big movements. And so we apply that same thought to marketing, which there's this belief. There's this belief that first there's a problem, an existential problem that you need to solve. Obviously, this is for your customer. And then there's this salvation to the problem. And the church or the belief or the religion is the playbook or the mechanism you bridge the gap between the two from problem to salvation. And so we needed to first come up with a strategic narrative which is like, what's the key commercial insight that's going to make people go like, huh, oh wait, actually, no, this does solve my problem. And then we have to make it into doctrine. It's our strategic narrative. We put this into content, making it into video form so people can easily consume it. And then we have missionaries. Missionaries are, instead of the popes, priests, pastors, or bishops, we have customers, integration partners, influencers, advocates, anybody in your ecosystem that is willing to preach the gospel, essentially. Because it's a lot more effective if it comes from somebody else. And that way, you also build, so because of the problem in salvation, you're creating your own category that's tied to a movement that's evolving in industry. And once people start talking about this on your behalf, not just your sales team or you, but other people, your missionaries are talking about it, that's when it can spread. And once they're talking about customers and customers are talking back, that's when you have a two-way dialogue and it's not just building an audience. And that's how it sustains, becomes sticky. And you know, that's when it really spreads like wildfire. I think marketing is taking this approach, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, is this the whole concept of trying to be viral? Like, is that the formula that you're trying to do?
I think virality is different. I've had videos that I've gone about. I posted a volcano video on TikTok because if anybody decides to follow my TikTok, it got 4 million views. Did any of that stuff convert? No. You can create viral content, but if it has no tie into the problem that you're solving or your gospel or what you're trying to preach and how they're going to achieve salvation, it doesn't really help you convert anything. So it's good for brand like, okay, great, there's a volcano video. I have no idea what Warmly is. I don't know what they do. I don't know who Alan is. They're very different.
Well, it sounds like, you know, because the virality seems like the vanity metric that's often being chased if you're getting into this, right? Like if you have your own brand, you're trying to break through, it's like, okay, if I just had one viral video, then at least everything would be solved. But you're talking about the fact that number one, it's not even a good leading measure because it's not going to give you the results you need that's actually tangible for a business. And now you're introducing a lot of church words, which I think is hilarious and probably very effective. And so I'd be curious to know if we could actually give an example of how you guys have used this church of marketing concept. You speak about the gospel, like what does that look like for you? And is this something that any company can build or do I need to be in a particular size or a particular niche?
I think it starts with any company from at least even in the very, very beginning of this. Those of you guys who haven't read Play Bigger, it was a big influence on me. Someone recommended to me to build a category for our product. And just to backtrack a little bit, the whole reason I got into marketing was because on the sales side, as we started coming up against bigger and bigger competitors and we were the new entrant, we needed a way to break through this red ocean of, we entered one of the most competitive spaces. And when people think of, you know, like chatbot, orchestration, or intent, they don't think of Warmly. They thought of like, oh, there's Sixth Sense, there's Demand Base, there's Qualify, there's Drift. You guys are just Sixth Sense, Demand-Based, Lead for Qualified, but combined into one. Like, so they couldn't really place us correctly. And in go-to-market tech, you can't just say you're cheaper. Ultimately, people want best-in-class tools. They don't care about how cheap it. They just care about results. Like, if you can deliver these results, that's what I'm goaled at. I don't win by saving money here. And so we needed to, oh yeah, you could use all those tools. That's totally fine. This is where you implement us alongside these other tools. Here's how we fit. Create our own category. That's why I needed to enter marketing. So how we did it was first, you know, of course, look at all the competitors in the space, really understand your positioning, how you're different, what you do, where you're going to grow into, what's the white space, what's the white hot center, as our investors calls it, that no one else really sees. Move into that. And for us, it was revenue orchestration. There's all these intent signals, there's all these tools out there, and it's really important to action on intent immediately because people have shorter attention spans, thanks to TikTok. Thanks to social media, 8-second digital attention span, as some studies say. And so if you don't action on it like that, then the opportunity is gone. So you need things to orchestrate very, very quickly to be able to capture the lead when it's hottest.
I have to interrupt real quick just because my audience, I have a feeling we don't fully understand the concept of orchestration because this is in the B2B space. But could you elaborate what revenue orchestration is?
Yeah, like I was mentioning, you have all these tools. You have ZoomInfo, which gets you all the contacts. You have Outreach, which allows you to sequence. You have intent data, like from Sixth Sense, website de-anonymization, third-party intent from Bombora, which is what people are researching on the web for you. And then all this stuff is kind of in disparate silos. And also you have your people, of course. So people, processes, tools, all these things need to come together almost perfectly to capture the lead when they're exhibiting high intent. For example, if they're on your website. An analogy here is like a storefront. Someone walks into your store is your company, and nobody's there to greet them. No one's there to say like, oh, you're looking for styling help for your pants. Yes, I know that. And here's your budget. Here's my recommendation. In fact, a lot of times, someone walks into a store, this is the metaphorical, your business, nobody's there to greet them. Instead, someone asks a question and you get back to them 2 days later. That's classic lead form fill. By that point, they're already gone. They've gone to a different store. They've already bought what they needed. So you'd be behind if you didn't orchestrate fast enough.
So orchestration is basically having everything in place so that when the person's ready to buy, you have an instant response and your processes are optimized and you need the data to see how they move around. And your tool is basically there to say like, oh yeah, we get to capture how this person moves. So we know what you need to do, when to do it so that it actually makes sense.
Exactly. You're optimizing the people, processes, and tooling. So it's the classic, you're hitting them at the right time with the right message to the right channel and to the right person. So I added the last one, the channel is actually pretty important too. Some people don't like to be called, some people want to be texted, all these things. But again, there's so many signals out there and it is picking the right signals and getting the right person to talk to the right person at the right time. It's better for the buyer because they're not being bombarded. It's better for the seller because a lot of times sellers spend 80% of the time on deals that will never convert and only 20% of the time is on deals that will. And so you're optimizing their time too, so they'll be happy. And there's also this component of you're automating a lot of the little pieces in between. Like, do you want your seller selling or do you want them doing a bunch of admin work? Probably want them selling.
I want to go back to the gospel concept. So how was the fact that this is what you do, how was that translated into a model that you're like, this is the gospel we preach for?
Do you mean like, how did we bring this out to the world?
Yeah.
Yep. So like I said, first thing is really dive in deep with competitors. I spent a lot of time on user interviews. I probably spent the first quarter and our CEO was like, kind of curious, like, where are all our leads? I'm like, okay, don't worry. They're going to come soon. The first month and a half in the first quarter was just spent researching. So a lot of user interviews with people who have used our competitors' tools. Like, what do you like about it? What don't you like about it? What are the biggest problems? And trying out some of the tools, talking to investors, just talking to as many people in the space until I got a handle on what the problem was. And the classic problem was like, okay, we have, like I said, all this intent data. We have all these processes. The problem is it's so difficult to organize all the people. Like first you hire a CMO, the CMO is like, let's do account-based marketing. That's the right thing to do. You know, we're going to find signals associated with accounts and then we'll get our reps to go talk to them at the right time. And then the CMO buys his tool. It takes months to set up. You need to get all these SDRs on board. By that time, you didn't generate any leads. The CMO is gone. All these SDRs have this new tool that they don't like using. New person comes in. There's also a maintainer of the tool. It's just this really big bloated process. And especially if you have people, it's very difficult to action on intent in that moment. People aren't necessarily fast enough to be like, in 8 seconds, I can give you exactly what you need. So it's a lot of speed, execution, fit, consistency, personalization, all these things. You can have automation and AI to help out so you can execute on perfect orchestration as opposed to a haphazard orchestration.
So I really like this aspect where you spend a lot of time having user interviews. And oftentimes you would assume maybe, oh, you could have just done a survey. How important was it for you to actually talk to the people when you do your market research?
Yeah, it's really important because each person is different. The weight of a CMO at a 1,000 person company is going to be a little bit different from the first starting marketer at a seed stage startup. And of course, their understanding of tools are different. So if you send a survey and 80% is like beginner marketers out there who just got a job and they started a startup and they're reading all these things online about how you're supposed to send a bunch of emails, it's just going to be different. So talking with somebody like, that was the guy that was at Affinity. Oh, okay. That's how Affinity, that was Segment. That's how they thought about it. And then you have a sense of, oh, okay. Like you get a lot more granular in a way that I think surveys don't give it to you.
Yeah. I remember when I was doing a product launch and people were just sending surveys to get some signals and get some results that they would help orchestrate their marketing. And I ended up going and doing user interviews of past buyers because I was relaunching a product. And then I started hearing some stories, like heart to heart stories about how things that they had bought had actually transformed their lives. And I was like, oh my God, I can actually use that in my marketing. Like I started actually building case studies in the email marketing, which was based on the story I had talked to somebody about. And I feel like in your case, I even saw on your website, you got some videos talking about like how this tool brings everything together. And you're probably bringing the examples of someone that talked to you on the phone to actually bring that up.
Oh my gosh, straight up. The best things that I write, the stuff in the video, it came from somebody else. A part of this whole missionary thing is I have 100 people on text message. So it's like 100 customers, influencers, people in the space who just know a lot more than I do, of course, who are in the trenches. I'll ask them like, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And they'll write like, this is the truth. It's not what you just said. It's this. I was like, okay, great. And I put it on LinkedIn. And then I see what the engagement's like. And if the engagement's really good, people are like, that's right. I agree. Okay, that goes in the video. And so it's this like series of collecting the best insights, aggregating it, tweaking it, putting it on LinkedIn to get feedback, and then putting some money behind it, either in paid or in video or in high production content.
Interesting. I want to go back to something you said earlier that I thought was very interesting, is you saw that the truth was kind of this blob that you had to keep poking at. Right. And I think I want to speak more about people that might be at the early stages and they're not necessarily in the B2B space. Maybe they're just building their own brand, building their own product, maybe just getting started. And you come in there with a lot of assumptions. It's almost like you're trying to find the product market fit. You're trying to, you know, just see what's the problem you're solving. You barely even know yourself because you're kind of discovering it. And when you speak about that blob, it sounds already what we've tackled here is, well, one of the ways to clarify and find truth from the blob is you have conversations. You said influencers, industry players, people that have been invested in these similar products or competitors, studying the competitors. These seems like big activities that chip away at the blob. Is there any other major activities you think are very essential for people to do to kind of get to that sense of truth so they don't waste as much time?
As far as product market fit goes, I think to be a practitioner of it, it's not actually marketing. It's just building the product, being in the trenches, looking for customer feedback, looking at, I think the most important thing is actually look at competitors. It's the shortcut. And this practice, where I've started another company again, it's this art of copying. And everything that we do at Warmly, or at least that I've done at least, is some derivation of something else that I've seen. And so our product is a derivation of other products. And so just, I think there was a point, this is our fourth pivot. So we've done this a lot. And finally, we found a good market, a good product, a good space, and good way to grow. I was just looking at all the Series B companies that have raised since 2018 and look at what their raise valuation is and then identifying, oh, this product right here is actually pretty interesting. Just seeing like that makes sense. Someone comes to the website, you get to reach out, talk to them in real time. You don't waste your time on anybody else. That makes a lot of sense. And I think that's where sales can go. And so looking at that product, it's like, wow, those guys raised 150 million in 3 years. And I talked to their customers, looked at the GT reviews. They're like, it's 5 out of 5. There's something here. How come nobody knows about them? And so without changing anything, just looking at that product, we're just like me and another engineer, we were just going to copy it, copy that product. And honestly, we didn't know why it worked. Like even today, we're learning new things about why that product works. If you take the approach, this is for founders out there, of I'm going to iterate my way, that is so slow, especially if you're not privy to the industry. Because in investment, if an investor looks at us, they're like, there's market risk, there's product risk, there's geographic. Why not try to eliminate as much risk as possible? If you copy a player that's already winning in the space that has customers and a market that understands the product, you've eliminated market risk, you've eliminated product risk. You're just kind of left with execution risk, assuming you're in the same geography as they. And we knew as a company, like we got really good at executing. We're just not the best, you know, at like ideating. I think most people are not. They think they have it, but they get excited about something. We do too. Sometimes you're just off mark. And over time, you get better and better at it, but why not just cut to the chase faster? So everything we've done, this is just for product, but like there's other things too, like marketing, sales, whatever, the art of copying.
Did at any point ego come into play in the sense that's like, oh no, we don't want to copy. We want to do our own thing. Like we're special and we're going to do something different. Because I'll see that. It sounds like you guys are more numbers driven, but I want to address for those who are like, well, I don't want to copy. I don't want to go back to that. Feels like playing low level. I'm an innovator. I'm going to do something brand new. I'm unique. I'm special. And I want to play on that. Has that ever come into play or has that ever had to be navigated?
Yeah, well, like I said, this is our fourth pivot. We've had 3 failed startups where we thought the world is going to understand our brilliance one day. They didn't. They never did. It's like maybe 1 million ideas out there at any given point in time and only like a couple, a handful of them are pretty good. But all of the other 1 million, they feel good. They seem right. And so would you rather take that risk or would you rather take the burden hand? The second thing is there's no ego behind it. Steve Jobs even said, good artists copy, the best artists steal. So you've had some of the greats. Like a lot of people say that, honestly. Yeah.
Fair enough. Is there rules around that? Are you allowed?
I think in the game of business, as long as it's not, you know, legally, you're not breaking any laws, then it's all fair, in my opinion.
Nice. Well, I'm really, really interested in this because, you know, you did a bunch of different pivots. Now, a lot of people, when it comes to even building a business and seeing that they missed the mark, that's enough to take them down and being like, I don't want to do this anymore. You've went and pivoted 3 times until you got to something that's actually at a point that it's working. So what were some of the things that made you all very motivated and focused on saying, we're doing a success here, even if we have to pivot and we didn't find success initially? You kept going instead of giving up. What do you think was what caused you to have that resilience?
If people think that I tried a thing, it didn't work, I don't know if they understand the true game. This whole startup thing is just a game, to me, at least. Of course, there's people out there with very like big missions and they want to achieve, they want to save the world. But at this level, the grandest scale, it's a really interesting opportunity to like, there's something in the world that's missing and there are players in it that are trying to capture it and it's changing. It's like signal-based sailing. That truth of what's missing in the world is dynamic. Every second it changes. And you're trying to figure out what, like I said, the true shape of the blob is. And if you can see that better than anybody else, then you can build a big business. Building a big business is just one way to manifest this all, of finding the truth and like actioning on it. And that's what I see it as. And so it's like, you know, there's me, there's my co-founders, we have one company, but there are other players too. There's like, you know, copy.ai, there's Qualified. Each of these companies has that person that's thinking in this way. So at the grandest scale, it's this meta game of chess. Who can see it more clearly? And these days, like, who can build a big enough following that other people can see the movement and tie themselves to and align themselves to your side versus their side? It's this meta game of chess. And I think that's fascinating. And why stop that? It's so interesting.
I'm very fascinated by the mindset that you have and the culture you have around this whole startup vibe, because for some people, this sounds like terrifying, high anxiety, high stress. And here you are, you're calling it a game, which might be mind-blowing for most people that could be listening to right now. But it sounds like what you're playing as the actual company, that's like your vision is anchored to something bigger where you're not as attached to the actual product. You're not attached to the actual thing that had to pivot. You seem to be attached to something bigger, which is the fact that, oh yeah, I'm playing a game of chess. I don't care if my pawn died because I've gotten to level up into a rook or something. And it seems to be the perspective you have, which I find is just a fascinating mindset.
Yeah.
Did you always have this mindset? Like, where do you think you built that? It seems like very culturally inherited from your environment, family, America. What do you think?
No, I think I've always been a tweaker, I guess. It shows my career, like, just try something else, keep going around. And I guess I've tried a lot of different things and I eventually had to learn to get good at them eventually. And so this is just the next thing to get good at. To be a founder, then no one talks about this job. They talk about there's sales that does the sales thing, there's customer success, there's engineering. They do all these functional things, but no one talks about this meta game that you have to play as a founder. And so it just ends up being the next thing that I have to win and be good at.
Yeah, I was going to say, the fact that you even started to play in this field, which is now very data-driven and AI is in this field, it seems like it's moving really, really fast. Is that in your advantage or is that adding to the pressure of the game?
It totally is. Right now, it's a race. And I said this a year ago to the team. I was like, there's going to be a future where there's going to be an AI SDR. Because the difference between speed to lead of a minute to seconds is like 10x, 100x even. But the difference between a second to nothing is like infinite. You can scale infinite, you can personalize infinitely. So the ROI in that is insane. The first company to get there, that's like Tesla full self-driving. You've won the market. You know what I mean? Like no one will be able to touch you at that point. You have so many cars out there on the road that's collecting petabytes of data every single day about images and what the driver does. Like you can't win. So like once you get that data moat and you create the system of full self-driving, in this case, it's full self-SDRing effectively, then it's going to be game-changing. So it's a race right now. It's very scary. And most people don't talk about it, but that's the game we're playing.
I find for me, I'm not even going to talk about who's listening to this podcast. For me, this is an entire game I don't even see us playing. I haven't even witnessed this game playing. You're in the middle of it. You understand. And this is kind of what you're saying, or this truth that you've seen because you've been poking at this blog, where most people are completely oblivious that this is happening. And I'd be very curious to paint that vision of the picture you know is coming into this fruition, like this zero, you know, a full automated SDR. Like, how does that change the everyday life of most people in the workplace?
You're gonna get a whole bunch more spam. We're gonna get it wrong in the beginning. It's gonna go sideways. It's not gonna look great to start off with, but it's kind of like this foggy river. You're crossing the foggy river. Like, we're getting there in the right direction to full SDR. That's good for the buyer. But in the beginning, it's gonna suck for a bit. And then we'll get better. And you know what's gonna happen next? There's gonna be tools out there that fight against the AI. It's going to be AI that combats the AI that says that automatically unsubscribes you, automatically puts you on do not call lists. And why would a company not buy that? Like, my gosh, my people are spending 30% of the time in emails and 80% of that is deleting spam. I'm going to buy that tool. So it'll be a battle, but over time, it's going to improve the buyer experience, I believe.
You know, for most people who aren't in this industry, the best way I could tangify this is like people writing essays in university using ChatGPT, and now professors have to get an AI tool to check if it was written by ChatGPT or not. But this is happening in the sales and marketing world right now. I think we've already noticed there's a lot of like, I'm seeing my inbox people pitching to be on the podcast, like they're AI tools that are doing it automatically. And you're just seeing a high volume of that. So this is like the messiness before it becomes beautiful and seamless, where like the future, I'm assuming after this chaos, messiness and annoyance that I think is coming our way, we're already seeing it. But the ultimate way, which I think kind of brings it back to this whole concept of selling with love, is you're going to get maybe one email in your inbox, but it'll be the exact email you need for the problem you're trying to solve now.
That's exactly right. This classic problem of sales and marketing, it's never been solved. There's so much money in there, it's never been solved. I'd say it's getting closer. Maybe one day it'll be like that and it'll be solved.
Are humans still required?
Of course, 100%. I think that it's going to be a hybrid. Some people take the full automation approach. We're just going to create the AI SDR. Some people take the humans-only approach. Recently, what we've seen is that personalization and non-sequencing and non-using AI, it's still the best performing. There's been a study on this. You take like a team that just personalizes, and then you take a team that just sequences and does like mass signal base, and then you compare the results. They're both using signals, actually. It's personalization always wins. I mean, what that tells me is that you still want a human touch. People still want to talk to humans. But the AI can do all the stuff up until the point we get on the phone together.
And as a sales rep, what makes me very excited is imagining me waking up and I'm seeing my calendar filled with people, and I have information on these people, on what they want, what they're looking for, and I can just jump on the call and saying, hey, all right, let's take this to the next step. And I'm seeing tools are sloppily getting there, but it sounds tools like yours are taking it a few steps to be even better and better. And we're heading towards that glory result, which I think is very fascinating. And I'm looking forward to see that world, both for sales, both for buying. You know, as a buyer, to me, it's like when there's some companies that do it so right. Like I've felt like we've had buying experiences where you walk in, you're like, oh, this is exactly what I need. I don't need to think. Thank you. And it sounds like what you're building is a solution to make sure that more conversations happen around that flow.
Exactly. Yeah. It is about improving the buyer experience. I think we all got carpet bombed for a little while after all the sequencing tools came out. We want to get away from that. Thank you, Google, for the bulk email send policy. Thank you, Yahoo, for minimizing how many emails get sent out. I think that's the step in the right direction. Over time, this tension between sales and protecting the buyer is going to like convene into the right buyer experience and the right sales experience.
It's almost like, well, you even got Europe that came out with GDPR, and then Apple did the privacy blocking on remarketing and tools like that. That hurt, man, as an online marketer. But, you know, we had to get more sophisticated. We had to get a bit better at the process. Alan, I've not had a fun conversation about marketing. And to be honest, I felt kind of out of touch talking with you. I feel like, oh my God, I've not kept a pulse on what's happening in the marketplace. And I feel like this is such a refresher to see like, okay, what's happening on the tech front? Because marketing tech around, or sales tech, I was a guy when I saw like HubSpot was coming out and I was like, this is cool. And now I'm like, oh, I'm getting old. There's a lot more out there and the landscape is changing. And I feel this whole conversation was about understanding what is the truth that's happening behind the scenes. Who are the players that are playing this game with, as founders, as tech, and that are growing? What is this whole orchestration of revenue that's happening behind the scenes and where this is all heading? And I think for my audience, this is not a conversation we've had in a long time on this podcast. And I'm very happy that we were able to bring this forward and bring this conversation, because I think we're going to be able to actually now see when we're receiving marketing material or sales material, or I'm going to your website and I'm seeing a pop-up chatbot with a human that's waving at me saying, chat with me. And I'm like, whoa, there's a lot of tools that are out there that are helping you make it more human. So we're spending the tasks or the time on what brings in results. And you guys are playing a cool part in doing that. So I'm very excited. I do have to ask you one question, because you are on the Selling with Love podcast. What does selling with love mean to Alan Zhao?
I think it's about selling authentically. And a lot of people, I think, build products where they sell products they don't believe in the value for, and they'll sell it. And for us, there was times in the past where we've done that, where we sold the product because we needed to and we think the market needed it. But selling with love at this stage is where we see the future going. We think it would be a disservice for you not to have this. And so we sell with love because it comes from an authentic place of wanting to actually produce value for you. We didn't always do that.
I'm glad you do now, man, because it sounds like you're going to be moving big boulders and making a big change. Honestly, Alan, is a pleasure to have this conversation. Thank you so much. Big things I'm picking up is I need to keep up to date on what's happening in the technology front. There's so much new stuff. I mean, AI, we've all been hearing these things. Maybe ChatGPT is the only thing you've been exposed to, but the ways that companies are working behind the scenes to bring the right messages and the right audience to make them take the right actions, this is going to change the entire buyer behavior cycle, whether that's B2C, B2B. And if there's a couple of terms that were thrown on today's conversation that you didn't quite pick up on, well, maybe there's going to be things you can go do some more research. I know I am getting a bit more curious about the whole field. I hope you do too. And if you have the need to see how you can actually use technology and AI to be more predictive on what you bring forward to the leads that come to your website, definitely check out Warmly. We'll put a link into the show notes, warmly.ai, and you'll be able to go and follow Alan on LinkedIn. There's tons of content being shared there. You'll be able to connect with him. And if you do, make sure you add a note, let him know you've heard him on this podcast. And Alan, once again, thank you so much for joining on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks so much, Jason.
I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.